Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is about 1:02 p.m. on Wednesday, June 2nd, 2021. Before we begin, I want to thank Leah Frazier, House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Nate Williams and Vanessa Head from the Juneau and Anchorage LIOs, who make sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those either in the room or on Teams or anywhere else participating to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have on Teams Representative Eastman. I don't see Representative Vance on Teams. If I'm missing something, if you could speak up. I don't see Representative Price-Tompkins. Representative Drummond is on the phone. Representative Kirk is on Teams. Representative Snyder is here in the Anchorage LIO with me and myself, Representative Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. And I would just note in terms of if we have a couple of other members of the committee, at this point just Representative Vance and Representative Christ-Tompkins, if you do join us, if you could either just say I'm here now or something. I guess you're not here to say that, but we'll try to note when you arrive we have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business today is House Joint Resolution 7, Constitutional Amendment, Permanent Fund and Permanent Fund Dividends, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the Governor. This is a third meeting of the joint resolution in the House Judiciary Committee, and today we're going to pick up with the questions we didn't completely finish with the Department of Revenue and potentially the Office of Management and Budget, and then we'll hear invited testimony from the Legislative Finance Division. And this is pretty much generally open to questions. The only thing I talked with Ms. Mahoney about the Harvard model, and I think the Department of Revenue provided an article, I think published by a Harvard publication from the Harvard Crimson, entitled "Harvard Will Draw Further from Endowment in FY 2022 Than Planned," citing strong market conditions. And we also provided to the committee a page from the Harvard Endowment reflecting, I believe, that the actual amount that Harvard relies overall for their endowment is approximately 37%, which was different than what we heard during the last hearing. And this is open for questions, and I would just note we're on the one-minute usual limit for questions, and just raise your hand, and if I don't see you or don't seem to recognize you, go ahead and speak up, and I'll get you in the queue. But questions for, let's see, present, we have Lucinda Mahoney, Commissioner Department of Revenue, Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner Department of Revenue, I believe Bill Milks may be on the phone from the Department of Law, I think Neil Steininger, possibly from the Office of Management and Budget, as well as Caroline Schultz, also from the Office of Management and Budget. So questions from members of the committee. Representative Snyder, if you want to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So kind of jumping back in to the presentation that we had previously, I know it's been a few days now. I think one of the questions that I was hoping to elaborate on here after we've had time to think on what was presented, in looking at the timeline for how the governor's plan would roll out, we do see revenue generation on the docket beginning in, 2024. It's the $150 million, shifting up to $300 million in 2025 and moving forward. And I understand the purpose of the bridge funding in the years prior, drawing from the ERA. My question, however, is why that order of operations? It seems that it would be more fiscally advantageous to, rather than overdraw significantly from the ERA, to bite the bullet and address the need for revenue generation many years sooner, rather than kick that particular can down the road for 3 to 4 years from today. Insights from your vantage point would be appreciated. Thank you.
I recognize Representative Vance joined us by phone at 1:05. Did you want Ms. Mahoney to answer that, or do you have a preference?
I think Commissioner Mahoney would be a great place to start. Thank you.
Ms. Mahoney. Ms. Mahoney, you need to unmute yourself. We can't hear anything yet. Commissioner Mahoney, can you hear us? Because we see that you're on Teams, but I'm hearing nothing from you. I see Mr. Barnhill is off also here. Mr. Barnhill, are you available? Because we're not getting anything from... Oh, now you're coming in. Okay. You need to unmute yourself, though. We see your image, but we don't hear anything. Still looks like you're muted. It looks like there's a mute button on that thing on the screen. We're working on the technological. Still don't. Oh, maybe she's hanging up and calling back. We have your image back. Still don't hear anything. Let's see if Mr. Barnhill, see if we're having more luck with you, if you can take a first stab at answering the question. We see you waving. Try speaking and see if we hear you. Well, we're not hearing you either, so why don't we take a brief at ease and we can see if we can get these technological challenges fixed. Brief at ease. Back on record, just as a matter of doing some high-tech testing here, Representative Kirka, can you say something and go off mute and say something and see if we're picking you up? It may be that we may need to go from the Teams to have everybody calling into teleconference. Representative Kirka, go ahead. We can't hear anything. Representative Vance, why don't you give it a try? No.
I received a text saying that they on Teams can all hear each other, but we can't.
Ah, it's even more frustrating. You know what I would suggest we do, rather than forge through this, if we can just all, rather than use Teams, if we all just want to call in on the legislative teleconference. Representative Grumman, you're on the phone. Can you hear us okay?
Yes, I can hear you.
So if the folks that are on Teams, just to try to move this forward rather than try to solve the technological glitch that seems to be with us, let's go off record for about 3 or 4 minutes, and then we'll come back. If everyone can just call in the legislative teleconference number, I think if you're in Anchorage, I think it's 563-9085. If you're in Juneau, I think it's 586-9085. And there's also an 800 number, but I don't know that. So we're going to go off record, and we'll resume in 5 minutes, and hopefully everybody will have called in successfully, including the folks invited to testify. Thank you. All right, we are back on record, and I think everyone, looks like everyone's called into the teleconference. See Representative Eastman, Representative Vance, Representative Drummond, Representative Snyder's here. Representative Kirkett, I don't see him on the teleconference. Hopefully he'll call in shortly. So the question, Ms. Mahoney, the question was directed to you with regard to, well, you remember the question. If you need a refresh, go ahead and ask, and Rep. Snyder can repeat the question. But Ms. Mahoney, I think you should be live now.
Chair Klayman, I do not have any. I don't hear any volume.
We can hear you.
Okay, I can't hear you. All right. Well, actually, I heard that. What was the question, Mr. Chairman?
I'll let Representative Snyder repeat the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, Commissioner. The question was, after we had our first hearing several days ago and opportunities to think on that information, receive some follow-up information, the way the governor's plan is set up now, of course, we're seeing the need for revenue generation beginning in 2024 at $150 million and then $300 million a year beginning in 2025. That could also be offered up, I suppose, as additional cuts, but I think we're all getting the sense that the appetite for those additional cuts, it may not even be possible given the additional about $265 million in cuts baked in the first couple of years in this plan. So with that information in mind, my resulting question is, if we've got revenue incorporated in this plan 3 years down the line, from your vantage point, why is that a more fiscally responsible position than rather biting the bullet and initiating the revenue generation as soon as possible, rather than and then reducing the need for such a large draw on the ERA?
Commissioner Mahoney.
Yes, through the chair. The reason why we estimate these revenues to come on in 24 and 25 is that we recognize that it will take time for the legislature as well as the administration to first decide and agree upon new revenues. And then potentially it could take another year, particularly if a broad-based tax is agreed upon, to implement those revenues. So it was simply just to reflect the time frame that would be required. However, I would say that to the extent that we can all identify revenues to come on earlier, I don't see any issues with that.
Follow-up?
Thank you. That's great. Thank you, Commissioner. So recognizing, yes, sometimes this machine moves slowly, but the administration is open to moving quicker if all parties involved can get on the same boat. And in that spirit, are there recommendations? I know when we spoke, must have been a week or two ago now, about possible revenue options. I know we have some proposed here in the legislature, and from the perspective of the administration, I think gaming came up once, and I would appreciate a refresher. I'm no longer remembering the estimate for what that could possibly bring in. And my understanding was there are a few other ideas, in the works. Since some time has passed since we last spoke, and we're looking at August coming up pretty soon, are there any other options that you and the administration could share that we can anticipate discussing?
I'm through the chair. We are exploring some very new tax-type revenue measures for the state of Alaska, but I cannot go into any of the detail relating to those yet because they have not been reviewed with the Department of Law. So I'm hesitant to make anything public on any of that until that process has been completed.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Commissioner. And for a final follow-up on this line, in previous presentations on this topic, it was presented, at least in the table that I've got from an earlier version of the PowerPoint, that the additional $150 million in 2024 and then, again, the $300 million subsequent years. It was also presented as cuts as a possibility to reach that target. In a similar line of questioning, do you have any recommendations on where those cuts might come from? Just some of the things that we've been advocating for and trying to maintain the budget that we're working with this year, it's become abundantly clear we're pretty darn close to what can be cut without seeing a drastic change in the delivery of critical services. So I'm curious if cuts are still on the table, or if so, where, or if the acknowledgement of revenue is becoming more and more of the top option.
To the chair, it is the governor's position that we will constantly be looking for opportunities to reduce spending and to identify efficiencies within the state of Alaska. As you pointed out, some of those opportunities were, as you used the word, baked in 22 and 23, but we're all working to continuously identify opportunities for improvement. If you recall on the slide that the original slides that I had presented, we had identified potential opportunities as a result of the increased asset value at our retirement funds. So to the extent that that investment value holds, we could see potential reductions in the state's contribution to the retirement accounts. Additionally, I had mentioned that we had reviewed the Department of Labor population estimates, and our population is declining somewhat. And so to the extent that some of our formulas for support throughout the communities incorporate populations as a variable, those programs could also see reductions.
Other members of the committee, at this point, because there's no place for you to wave your hand, if you have questions, speak up, and if you want to be in the queue because somebody else is asking questions just during a short pause, just ask them to put you in the queue. Any other representatives on the committee with questions for Ms. Mahoney or Mr. Barnhill or others here from the administration? I'm not hearing anything. I'll ask a couple of questions I had. Commissioner Mahoney or Mr. Barnhill, there was reference, and I think the governor referenced in his State of the State address, talking about introducing a measure for gaming and making money off state revenue off gaming. Is there a proposal that the governor has put forward for a gaming change to statute that would allow essentially gambling, not just the pull tabs that we have today, but other revenue and what that proposal is and any estimate on how much that would generate?
Mr. Chairman, we are currently working with a consultant who is actually in the state right now working with stakeholders to gather information about potential gaming in our communities. And we are awaiting information from them in regard to an estimate of revenues. And until we get a final number, it would be inappropriate for us to speculate until we have the final report.
And then another follow-up, not on the gaming question, but in terms of revenue measures, is there any revenue measure presently before the legislature that's been proposed by the governor?
Through the chair, I'm not aware of any.
And I know that the revenue measures are a topic for the special session scheduled, the second special session to begin in August. Can we anticipate seeing one or more revenue measures introduced by the governor in advance of that session?
Mr. Chairman, there are other agenda items for the special session in August, and revenue measures are one of them. That would be, I would need to consult with the governor to ensure that that is the direction.
I'm certainly aware that there are other measures on the call, and so the reason I was specifically directing my question to the part of the call that specifically mentions discussion of revenue measures, and so at this point it sounds like the answer is right now you can't say whether there will or won't be any revenue proposal from the governor by the time of the August session.
Mr. Chairman, I can say that it is on the call, and I am hopeful that they will be discussed, but that decision really will be a part of the overall plan that is rolled out for that session.
Representative Chairman, Mr. Chairman, this is Representative Kirka. I have a question.
Glad, Representative Kirka, for some reason I don't see you on the list, but glad you're here on the phone. Please proceed.
Thank you. Through the chair, I noticed on that second call, kind of a similar line of questioning, this was a question presented to me to, I guess, put forward here in the meeting. One of the items on the call in the fall is, or I guess August is really summer, but...
we still like to think of that as summer, Representative Kirka.
Yes. One of the items is a proposal to put a constitutional amendment forward, if I recall correctly, to require that any new tax would have to be approved by the voters. And I guess my question is, that seems that that's a similar component to requiring any change to the PFD formula being approved by the voters, such as the amendments we're discussing now in this special session. And I guess my thought is, why not have those two discussions kind of seem to go together, number one? Number two, why not have them in the same amendment? And maybe that's a kind of a tragic, a strategic policy question that maybe is more for the governor, I guess.
I do think that's a question for Commissioner Mahoney. So, Commissioner Mahoney?
Through the chair, I mean, I'd just like to point out, as Mr. Kirka iterated there, that there are several constitutional amendments that are on the call. You know, the spending limit, any additional broad-based taxes requiring a vote of the people, as well as the permanent fund amendment. And so the intent is that all of those amendments are a part of an overall comprehensive plan and should be discussed in tandem.
Representative Kirk, any follow-up? I can't see whether you want follow-ups. I'll be a little more direct than follow-up, Representative Kirk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That makes sense, but I guess I'm kind of wondering, why not have that also part of the discussion on voter approval of a change in the PFD formula, which we're looking at now with this new proposal?
The recent amendment changes that the governor has proposed in regard to the formula would be considered as a part of the call.
Okay, just a quick follow-up. So if we don't deal with this special session, if I understand you correctly, Commissioner, this constitutional amendments we're discussing in this call, the first special session call, will be part of the second special session call. Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, correct.
Thank you.
Representative Kirk, any other questions?
Not at the moment.
Thank you. Representative Drummond, Representative Vance, Representative Eastman, any questions for the administration?
Yes, I have a question.
Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And this question is could be for anyone. One of the questions that I'm fielding from constituents deals with the various portions of the governor's plan. And I'm just wondering, is there a way to bring together all of the portions of the plan into a single amendment resolution? I know there's concerns over some gamesmanship if the people are voting with one expectation, but not all of the parts of the plan end up actually being moved forward and going into law.
Through the chair, I would refer that to Mr. Barnhill, our attorney.
Mr. Barnhill.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. And I am an attorney, but I don't appear here as an attorney, just a junior bureaucrat in the Department of Revenue.
And I will note for the record that Mr. Barnhill is a member of the, I believe you're still an active member of the bar, but he is not working for the Department of Law, and so he is not offering the Department of Law's perspective.
I am not, though I like to play in that sandbox sometimes. But not today. Mr. Chair, Representative Eastman, the question is, can all of the elements of the governor's proposal be assembled into one vehicle? And in fact, in the Senate, that has happened in the form of a committee substitute for SJR 6, Judiciary. And those, we've gone over the elements of that proposal, which is to constitutionalize the percent of market value formula, to put into that formula in the Constitution a not more than 5% of the percent of the five-year lagging market average, to constitutionalize the allocation between PFD and government spending, and to also constitutionalize a dedication to power cost equalization, and to place the balance of the power cost equalization endowment fund into the permanent fund. So those are all the elements. They're not before this committee. A means by which to do that would be to, through a vehicle similar to HGR 7 or to have a committee substitute prepared. But the chair has been very gracious in allowing the administration latitude to discuss the elements of the governor's proposal from the Senate vehicle, and that's certainly appreciated.
Representative Eastman, follow-up?
Great, thank you.
And just for the other members of the committee, I'll be asking each of you follow-up after each time until you get done with your follow-ups, because I can't even begin to tell whether you want to follow-up or not. So go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. So to circle back around to a question that we touched on lightly in the last hearing, I'm a little bit concerned still that if the constitutional language were to go forward and be put into law, and someone has the expectation based on the language in the Constitution that according to law the legislature is in essence directed to put money aside to equalize the cost of power throughout the state. But the concern is that at some point the future legislature is going to say, yeah, we just don't want to do that, and then we're going to be right back in the same place we are with the dividend, or they say, yeah, all right, there's according to law, and the law says, but, appropriations, we just don't feel like power cost equalization is a priority this year. And I'm just wondering if where are we at in that discussion? I know we kind of circled around it a few times in the last hearing. What's the governor's position on that today?
And Mr. Representative Eastman, do you want Mr. Barnhill to answer that and Ms. Mahoney for a preference?
I suppose it could be for either, but let's start with the commissioner.
I'll have Mr. Barnhill address that, please.
So, Mr. Chair, again for the record, Mike Barnhill, Representative Eastman. And Mr. Chair, if I could just again ask latitude from the chair to refer to the SJR 6 and the Senate. I don't know if it's before committee members or not, but I'll just refer to line numbers. So the Representative Eastman's question, I believe, is answered in CS for SJR 6 Judiciary on page 2, lines 10 to 14. And the phrase shall appropriate is inserted in, is proposed to be inserted into the Constitution. So I don't believe the legislature would be able to circumvent the constitutional language, which says the legislature shall appropriate, and it goes on to say a portion of the amount for power cost equalization. And then the word shall is used again in line 12, the amount appropriated shall be the amount necessary to equalize the cost of power in the state. The drafters have used the word shall twice, and that probably reflects a drafter intention to limit, if not make impossible, the ability of the legislature to circumvent making an appropriate appropriation for power cost equalization under this section.
So I have a quick follow-up for Mr. Barnhill, and then I'll go back to Representative Eastman. You talked about how the Senate Joint Resolution 6 has all the components of the fiscal plan going forward, but it doesn't have any revenue component, and my understanding is that there's really four parts to the plan, one of which is revenue. So isn't it fair to say that SJR 6 also doesn't have anything about revenue?
Mr. Chair, that's correct, and forgive me. I should have said that it contains all the components of the governor's plan that he proposes to constitutionalize. But there remains a role for the legislature, and we discussed this a bit in the last hearing in terms of to the extent that revenues don't materialize in the amount forecast in the scenario that we've placed before the committee in 10 years, 20 years, or even 5 years for that matter, the legislature will always retain its ability to enact statutes to raise revenue. And then similarly, with respect to power cost equalization specifically, the legislature has the role through statute of deciding how to equalize the cost of power throughout the state. And so those are two elements of the governor's plan that aren't in a constitutional resolution because discretion is preserved for the legislature to legislate on those matters.
Right. The legislature have to make a proposal, which at least so far in revenue the governor has been unwilling to do. Representative Eastman, follow-up. I apologize for stepping in with that one question, but it followed up on your earlier question. Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And so based on the drafter's intent of the shall language, what is the remedy if the legislature just decides not to do that? They appropriate a minimal amount.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, probably starting to get into the Department of Law territory and Mr. Milks, but you know, whenever there's a possible constitutional violation, people of the state of Alaska have standing to bring litigation to enforce the Constitution, and indeed. Indeed, they do so with some frequency.
Further questions, Representative Eastman?
That's all for now. Thank you.
Representative Vance, any questions?
Not at this time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Drummond, any questions?
I'm good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Kirk, any additional questions?
Negative.
Doesn't sound like. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm saying negative. I'm good for now.
Okay. Representative Snyder, any additional questions? Okay. So it looks like we have exhausted all the questions from the committee, and that brings us to our second presenter today, it looks like Alexi Painter from Legislative Finance. We have some slides that were provided earlier. Mr. Painter, I know you don't have control of the slides, so if you'll just tell us when to turn the page, and we'll follow along. That should be visible for folks watching online, as well as members of the committee should have the printout of the presentation either on your computer, or if you may have printed it out. There was an additional page that that they provided, I think late in the morning, as part of the presentation. But Mr. Painter, please proceed, and I'll let you go ahead and finish your whole presentation. When you're ready for questions, let us know, and then we'll go through the questions from the committee.
For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division, and I would be happy to take questions as we go. If you prefer, it may be a little easier to get clarity as we go, but whatever is the preference.
Why don't you go for two or three pages, and then after two or three pages, we'll take a pause and see if there are questions on the first two or three pages, and then keep going that way. At some point, because most of us are online, it just sometimes it's even more confusing to try to figure things out without just getting through the presentation.
Okay, for the record again, Alexei Painter, Legislative Finance. Go ahead on to slide two. So I was asked to talk about the governor's fiscal plan and the assumptions therein. And just before I get started with specifics, the Legislative Finance Division has the purpose of our fiscal modeling is to show policymakers the long-term impact of fiscal policy decisions. So we start with baseline assumptions that essentially are that current budget levels will be maintained and adjusted for inflation, and then any other changes, policy changes, are policy decisions the legislature is making. So our baseline is just current trends. We've often referred to that as our current law or current policy, depending on the context, baseline. So our assumption is that the default is that you will follow statutes on items, statewide items and the permanent fund dividend and any draw limits that you set up in statute. If a legislator asks for something else to be modeled, we'll model the policy intervention they're asking for. So this is significantly different than how the administration or any political actor really would model, because the administration's 10-year plan is not designed to be a policy-neutral document. It's designed to be a plan for policy changes the administration wishes to make. And so I think sometimes there's confusion when their plan, which has in it many policy changes, is treated as a baseline rather than a policy document. So as we go forward, you'll see these differences are mainly between our current policy or current law baseline, and then the administration's policy proposals on top of that. The additional document that was distributed this morning is actually a joint document prepared by my office and the Office of Management and Budget that gives some comparisons of our baselines to the Office of Management and Budget's policy decisions. I'm not going to go through that document itself. It's more of just kind of a one-page overview, but as I go through the slides, we'll talk about these different assumptions that they're making or these policy choices they're making. And one other note is that long-term models like this are extremely sensitive to the assumptions and the inputs that go into them, especially assumptions that are made or policy changes made at the beginning and then run through compound interest. So if you cut $100 million in the first year and then that goes through compound interest of, you know, 2% a year, that shows up as a pretty large policy intervention. And so that's just important to understand that relatively small changes up front can make a big difference over the long term. Going on to slide three. So our baseline revenue assumptions are the same as the Department of Revenue spring revenue forecast. So as a refresher, that assumes $61 oil in FY22, and that grows with inflation in future years. The DOR's spring revenue forecast also uses a production forecast from DNR that projects that Alaska North Slope production will increase actually from FY22 to FY30. And for the permanent fund, our current assumption is that that in FY21, the permanent fund's April 30th statement turns into the actual earnings for FY21. And then for future years, we assume the 6.2% Callan assumption that's their official or will become their official forecast soon. Here on to slide four, our spending assumptions. So for agency operations, we're actually currently using the Senate's first committee substitute of the operating budget, which is about $3.87 billion of UGF, and then it grows with inflation at 2%. The reason we're using this budget as a starting point is because it was intended to be essentially a clean starting point, There's no one-time funding sources in that version. There's no unsustainable fund source swaps or anything like that. It, as opposed to, you know, the governor's budget, the House budget, or the budget the Senate actually ended up adopting, is really just a clean starting point moving forward. And it's very similar to what we had had as our current policy baseline at the beginning of session. For statewide items, our baseline is the assumption that all items are funded to their statutory levels. That includes school debt reimbursement, the regional education and educational attendance area fund, community assistance, and the permanent fund dividend. In this case, the models will be showing model SJR, or I believe the governor's fiscal plan has a dividend of 50% of the of the percent of market value draw, so that's the amount in these models. We also include baseline fund transfers of $14.6 million that's kind of an ongoing cost of the spill prevention response program. For the capital budget, again, we're using the Senate's first committee substitute, which was $176.7 million, growing with inflation. We use this because this is, again, kind of a clean starting point. It represents the governor's original amended requests, so through February before some additional requests came through, without using any one-time fund sources or unsustainable fund sources. So again, it's a pretty clean starting point to move forward. For supplementals, we've had an assumption for several years now of $50 million of supplementals per year. That's based on the average amount of supplemental appropriations we've had over the past 5 years when you subtract out lapsing funds. So I can pause for questions before we get into the numbers showing how these compare to OMB's plan.
That is a good place. If you've got questions, member committee members, any questions for members of the committee about pages 1 through 4, really 2 through 4 of the Mr. Painter's presentation? I'm not hearing any committee members speaking up with questions. So, Mr. Painter, if you want to proceed.
Okay, moving on to slide 5. So this shows the full table of our baseline spending assumptions. And so you can see the agency operations of 3.87, full funding of statewide items reflected there. Those actually spike a little bit and then fall, and that's because of oil tax credits based on the spring forecast. If we pay the statutory amount for oil tax credits, we'll pay them off somewhere in the FY26-27 range. So then we have a lower assumption beyond that. We have a reduction built in for Senate Bill 55. That was a bill that passed both bodies of the legislature that decreased the budget by $25.7 million, the capital budget, our fund transfers, and supplemental assumptions. So put together
I know we're not taking, but just for my, to clarify, when you're referencing the oil tax credits, is that going to show on the statewide full funding line as opposed to agency operations?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Oil tax credits are counted as a statewide item.
Okay, thank you.
So the total budget is $4.74 billion in FY22, and then overall, it actually grows a little slower than inflation because of those tax credits falling off, even though many of these items actually do grow with inflation. And so this is our starting point. That FY22 budget level is pretty similar to the governor's amended budget. And then if we go to the next slide, slide 6, this compares our baseline to the governor's 10-year plan. So the negatives are where the governor's 10-year plan are lower than our baseline. The positives are where it's higher. And you'll see that in FY22, they're fairly close, but there's some differences because the governor has a lower level of agency operations than in the both the House and the Senate budgets. And the governor funds several statewide items at 50% of the statutory level, which accounts for that difference, specifically the school debt reimbursement and REAA fund. The governor also only funds the DGF portion of community assistance. He does not fund the UGF portion, so that accounts for a difference there. And you can see that the difference between our baseline and the governor's assumption grows over time, and that's because the governor has those built-in reductions in FY23 and 24 to agency operations, and then a lower spending growth rate. So you can see the largest area of difference between our assumptions is in agency operations, that first line, where really that's the smaller starting point in FY22, those reductions in 23 and 24, and then the lower growth rate of 1.5% versus 2%. That ends up with nearly $500 million lower in agency operations by FY30 because of those assumptions combined, or those policy choices combined, I should say. And the statewide items, that difference, a lot of that is school debt reimbursement and the REAA fund. Another difference is actually we're using slightly different numbers for retirement, and that's just a technical difference. The governor's 10-year plan uses the officially adopted ARM board numbers, which were adopted by the ARM board back in June and then updated in September. And we're using the draft numbers that are from December. They incorporate actuarial losses experienced in FY20, so they're a little more up-to-date, but they're not the official numbers. So the governor is sticking to the official numbers at this point, and those are a little bit lower. So that doesn't represent a policy choice. It's just a matter of using official versus draft numbers. And then on to slide six, some descriptions of these, or sorry, slide seven, some descriptions here. So the major policy differences that the governor is making, or policy calls the governor is making in this spending plan, are funding school debt reimbursement and the REAA fund at 50% of the statutory levels, which are in line with his vetoes in FY20. The lower agency operations in FY22, and then those additional reductions in 23 and 24, the lower growth rate. He assumes no future supplementals. And in discussions with OMB, a lot of the reason for that assumption is that the governor has made some increases to the operating budget to offset areas where there used to be routine supplementals. So, for example, Medicaid, there was a large supplemental in FY20, and then the funding level was increased in FY21. In theory, that should reduce future supplementals. And just to be clear, this level of budget reductions is not unattainable, but, you know, it would require significant policy choices to realize. You're not going to get to $500 million less in agency ops than essentially where we are now without making significant policy choices. And I can either pause there or keep going into the more comprehensive plan.
This is probably a good place to pause because this has got the comparison. So the last three slides, 5, 6, and 7, are the comparison. Questions from members of the committee? Representative Snyder, yeah. She's got the advantage of being over here, so I can see her raising her hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Painter. Through the chair, I think I know the answer. I just want to confirm here. So on slide six, we're looking at the differences between the two, with the governor's plan and the LSU baselines. These differences are not assuming any form of revenue generation. Rather, it's relying on reductions. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Snyder, this is just showing the budget side, so we're not in the revenue side yet. So regardless of what you do on revenue, these are the spending targets in the governor's 10-year plan.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Representative Snyder.
On a slightly different topic, can you speak a little bit more to this difference between 1.5% versus 2% inflation beyond FY24? What's driving the difference? Which one is more realistic? What factors would play into seeing one and not the other? How does it compare to what we're seeing now?
Through the chair, Representative Snyder, so the governor's 10-year plan is to hold agency operations below, the growth of agency operations below the level of inflation. We have done that over the past 5 or 6 years. The FY22 budget in both bodies' versions and in the governor's version are actually pretty comparable to the FY18 budget, for example, just in nominal terms. So despite inflation over that time, we've held the budget flat for 5 years or so. So the assumption is that we would reduce the budget and then hold the growth below inflation. That would require, either holding items, large items like the formula programs like Medicaid, holding that below inflationary growth, holding the K-12 formula below inflationary growth, or holding inflationary agency operations below. So, you know, the pay of state workers, for example, or benefits would have to, the growth of those or the number of state would have to be lower than inflation, or we'd have to reduce the state workforce to offset those inflationary adjustments in bargaining unit contracts.
Final follow-up.
Representative Snyder.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Painter. I think we had heard, in a previous meeting that there's concerns about also built into this plan is essentially staying with a flat budget in perpetuity and incorporating in those cuts in revenue generation that we've seen in earlier tables. But we had been reassured that we would increase according to inflation to at least attain that flatness, which is in and of itself problematic, but a starting point in conversation. But I think I'm hearing from you that that's not quite true, that we would not be keeping up to the rates of inflation.
Through the chair, Representative Snyder, I believe the governor's plan is to hold spending growth slightly lower than inflation. So, yes, that would be a policy choice to hold growth in real terms, to shrink the budget.
Thank you for that clarification.
Other questions from members of the committee?
Yes, I have one.
Is that Representative Eastman?
It is, yes.
Yes, please proceed. Just want to make sure I got the voice right. Go ahead.
Thank you. And this question's for Lexi. So now I'm remembering that the House and Senate version of the budget differed significantly on things like reverse sweep language. I'm just wondering if the Senate's version of the budget omitted that language, doesn't it possibly contain appropriations from funds that may not necessarily be capitalized if the reverse sweep doesn't make its way into the budget?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, the reverse sweep was included in the House version, but the vote on it failed. So in the version that actually passed the body, there was no reverse sweep language. The Senate did not include it and did not take that vote. That can be added in conference committee. If it is not added and not voted on, it's possible that some of those appropriations that are in both versions of the budget from sweepable accounts could not take effect, similar to the budget a couple of years ago when the budget was passed without a reverse sweep.
Follow-up?
Thank you.
Representative Eastman, any follow-up?
No follow-up needed. I just wanted to just confirm that passage of that CBR reverse sweep is sort of predicated or a foundation to what we're talking about. Okay.
Any other members of the committee with questions at this point from Mr. Painter? I don't hear any. I have a couple of questions. The first is that the 2% versus 1.5% inflation rate, what is the basis that Ledge Finance is coming up with the 2% inflation rate?
Mr. Chairman, 2% is the officially adopted inflation rate from Callan and Associates, which is our investment manager our investment consultant for the permanent fund and the ARM board. That number has been 2.25% for several years, but it is being reduced in the most recent the most recent numbers, to 2%. That's actually in line with the Federal Reserve targets, so we feel that it's a reasonable assumption going forward.
But just from a standpoint of the 1.5% versus the 2.0%, if the inflation rate did pick up, and we don't know what that's going to happen in the future, but if that went up, then that would have a similar change in the overall number.
Mr. Chairman, yes, in our modeling that uses inflation as kind of the basic growth rate, if we had a higher inflation assumption or if inflation actually does increase, that would increase our baselines for future years.
And I just want to make sure I'm tracking the slides accurately. If I'm looking at page number 6, if I'm looking at the agency operation difference on the top line, the change from FY22 at $65 million to FY23 at $182 million, that reflects the governor's goal of reducing by another approximately $150 million for the FY23 budget?
Mr. Chairman, it's really about $100 million. The reason that difference is a little more is because the baseline is increasing with inflation as well. So not only is the governor decreasing the budget, it's also not growing with inflation. So that's why the difference ends up being a little more than $100 million.
And then from moving from FY23 to FY24, does that reflect essentially the $150 million further reductions?
Mr. Chairman, it's again, it's really $100 million, but also not doing the inflationary growth. So I think it's kind of a semantic question of, are you reducing it by $100 million below last year's level, or are you reducing it by $150 million below last year's level adjusted for inflation? I think either one would be an accurate description of the governor's plan in those early years where you're not growing with inflation.
So we can think of it at, when we hear the 150 number, that's really 150 reduction from the prior year adjusted upward for inflation, or you can say it's a $100 million reduction. That's a bit more because that then is also adjusted for inflation.
Mr. Chairman, that's how our comparisons appear, yes.
And that 150 that the governor talks about, that's all in agency operations. That's not the statewide or capital or any of the other differences?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's true, but I can't really speak for the administration on where that number came from.
At least based on the analysis that you're working on.
Yes.
So does that mean that if we are, for FY23 and FY24, if we were unable to achieve those reductions in each of those years, and we were also to add in the revenue proposals that's included in some of the governor's plans that are, I think, a $300 million revenue proposal, if we had the revenue, and then we also had to have additional revenue to make up for the cuts that we were unable to find, if we're adding that 150 twice and that 300 million, we're more at a 500 to 600 million revenue need to keep the budget balanced, not at just a 300 million revenue need.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. If you do not reduce the budget as the governor is proposing and you constitutionalize the PFD, so that's no longer kind of a lever you can use to balance the budget, really that would come down to needing revenue reductions of that size, or revenue increases, sorry, of that size to balance the budget.
Okay. Other questions from members of the committee for pages 4 through 7? I'm not hearing any. Mr. Painter, if you want to pick up with page 8.
Okay, so slide 8. So the governor's plan is more than just the spending side. So they take that OMB 10-year plan for spending and then add in $300 million of new revenue. In some things that they've said that could be additional budget reductions, but we're calling it new revenue, beginning midway through FY24. And it constitutionalizes the PFD at 50% of the POMV drop. So on the following slides, we'll show some of our results of the fiscal modeling of those assumptions. Going on to slide 9. This slide shows if you only adopt the governor's, the revenue side of the governor's plan and not the spending side. So if you do not adopt the OMB 10-year plan and use our baseline, but do have the $300 million in new revenue and constitutionalizing 50% POMV, as well as the $3 billion transfer in the first year. So the surplus deficit line, you can see that we would still have a significant deficit without those spending reductions, $1.5 billion in FY22. It does shrink over time, in part with that $300 million, but also because revenue is growing faster than inflation. The graph on the left compares unrestricted general fund revenue to the budget. The blue in the bars is traditional revenue. The green is the POMV draw. The orange is draws from the constitutional budget reserve or statutory budget reserve. The red is that $3 billion draw that's planned in, that $3 billion one-time draw. The solid line is the budget less the dividend, and the dotted line is the budget including the dividend. And I think one thing that's notable here is that the bars and lines do not meet starting in FY25. So in this scenario, if we don't have those budget reductions again, it would be an unfilled budget hole in FY25 and beyond. On the right, you can see our reserve balances. So the orange is the constitutional budget reserve. The green is the ERA. The ERA goes away in FY23 because of the constitutionalized POMV. It is no longer accessible as a budget reserve in that scenario. Going on to slide 10, these numbers should match.
Just one quick clarification before you go to slide 10. The line, the dotted line that reflects the budget that includes the dividend, is that assuming it, the 50-50 split dividend that's estimated at about $2,300?
Mr. Sherman, yes. That is with the governor's 50-50 dividend, the $300 million of revenue, but not the spending side.
Okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, moving on to slide 10. This shows numbers that are very similar to what you've seen from the administration. This shows if you have the governor's spending reductions included as well. And so the surplus deficit numbers start out with a deficit of $1.4 billion, but shrink rapidly to where we have a balanced budget by FY27 and growing into surpluses. And then you can see that we maintain on the right a CBR balance that actually starts growing as the surpluses go into the CBR in those years. So our modeling, when you use the governor's policy interventions, essentially matches almost, you know, I think we're maybe a couple of million dollars off, but our numbers are extremely close to theirs when you put in all their assumptions. So the differences in between our modeling and theirs is not a matter of kind of our baselines or anything like that. It's those policy changes in that the governor is proposing in his plan. And this second one, I think, really matches pretty closely what you've seen from the administration. So going on to the final slide, slide 11. So the governor's plan works fiscally if the budget reductions and new revenue are agreed to based on the current revenue forecast. So our modeling, that slide 10, shows that if those things occur, the 50-50 dividend and constitutionalizing the PCE plan do balance the budget. If oil revenue turns out to be lower than spring forecast, as DOR has said, you would need to have more budget reductions or more new revenue to balance the budget versus what are in the governor's plan. Or, of course, as the chairman said, if you're not able to achieve the spending reductions that the governor is laying out, you would need to add in more revenue to make up for it. So right now, the legislature essentially has four main levers to use to balance the budget. You can draw from savings accounts, including the ERA, although that's not really a true savings account because we use it as an ongoing source of revenue. You can reduce the PFD, you can reduce the budget, or you can increase revenue. The governor's plan removes the first two of those options. You can no longer draw from the ERA. We don't have significant reserves to fill deficits out of the CBR beyond that $3 billion that they call the bridge, and you cannot reduce the PFD. So that leaves you with the last two options, reducing the budget or increasing revenue. So if we have if we have reduced revenue below the forecast, then you would really just have those two options. And without ERA access or significant savings balances, the legislature would be forced to act pretty swiftly to resolve any fiscal imbalance in the future. Right now we have the luxury of, we've had over the past few years, significant balances in the SBR and CBR that are no longer there, that kind of gave us an ability to, you know, weather some minor storms. Without those and without being able to either draw from the ERA or reduce the dividend or anything else, really, if we ran into issues on the revenue side, we would have to act pretty quickly to resolve that. We wouldn't have that luxury of time anymore. And I want to make a correction. I misstated on slide 9. Slide 9 does not include the $300 million in new revenue. I apologize. It just is the 50-50 plan with no other policy interventions. So it does not include that $300 million of revenue in slide 9. Okay, and that is the last of my slides. I'm happy to answer any further questions.
Questions for Mr. Painter? Representative Snyder would welcome others to go before she does this time. Any questions from other members of the committee? Representative Snyder, doesn't look like you're getting it out. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Painter. Through the chair, in your slide here on page 10, and also I know it was highlighted in a different visual in a presentation from the commissioner some time ago, there's this projected surplus. In the commissioner's presentation, it was up to $393 million by FY30, and I'm not sure, I guess my first question is that a similar projection is harder to determine on the way the data are presented here on slide 10? Does that sound, according to your models, like the surplus you would see? And then I would do a related question. Also, my understanding with that calculation of the surplus is that assumes that we are also paying off some existing debt, school bond debt, oil tax or oil credits. I would just anticipate that there may also be future debts that would then eat into that surplus, which would discolor the interpretation of the visual representation. If you could speak to one, is that $393 million by FY30 consistent with your models? And two, is it reasonable to expect a surplus based on historical accumulation of debt?
Through the chair, Representative Snyder, our modeling shows, with the governor's spending assumptions, $395 million of surplus in FY30, so almost the exact same. And I think there's a few kind of important things about debt to be clear on. One is, with oil tax credits, there's no ability to earn new credits, so there's kind of a fixed universe of credits, and it's just a matter of when we pay them off. So in the assumption in our baseline that we follow the statute and pay $114 million this year, $117 million next year, and so forth, those would get paid off somewhere, I think, in FY26, and that's why you see kind of a big difference in the surplus deficit numbers there, is that expense falls off. School debt reimbursement, we've extended the moratorium on new debt through FY25, so the numbers that we have for school debt reflect all of the debt that's currently outstanding. I would expect that if that moratorium is allowed to lift in FY25, you would see new debt adding on in future years. So to some degree, that that amount of surplus would decrease when the moratorium comes back on. But in the governor's plan, you're only funding half of that, so it would be a relatively small amount. The last year of the wise tax credit is FY27, not FY26. It's a partial year in FY27, I believe. And so the school debt reimbursement amount would, I think our model is showing a little low because it's assuming that no new debt comes in after the moratorium is lifted. But I think it's kind of unknowable how much that amount would be. Another factor is the governor has, or the administration has talked about using bonding to make up for restrained capital budgets. That future bonding is not reflected here. So if they did that, if we took advantage of bonding and bonded for additional capital projects during this period, that debt service would also reduce that surplus. So, there's a couple of factors there that definitely could cause that surplus to be decreased. We also do owe the Constitutional Budget Reserve something like $11 or $12 billion, so that's another debt that we could consider paying off that surplus, which is what we have reflected in our model.
Thank you.
Questions from other members of the committee? Again, I'm not hearing any. I do have a couple of questions. Mr. Painter, if you could turn back to slide 9. So the difference between the governor's budget line and the revenue projections, if we had $300 million in new revenue starting in FY25, would that be a balanced budget on this slide?
Mr. Chairman, no, there would still be a deficit. So in those out years in FY25, 27 and beyond, where there's surpluses in the governor's scenario, there would still be deficits in this scenario of $300 to $500 million, even with that added $300 million of revenue.
And in terms of the CBR, the current amount that we owe back to the CBR is now $11 to $12 billion.
Mr. Chairman, that's, I think, our latest estimate is something like $11 or $12 billion after FY21's books are closed, assuming the sweep is reversed.
So on a completely different note, Representative Snyder asked a question earlier to the Department of Revenue about why make this $3 billion bridge draw that's breaking the POMB law from SB 26. Why do the draw first and revenue later from a fiscal policy perspective? Are there advantages to passing the revenue first before doing anything else? And can you provide your analysis of that question? And recognizing at the end it all comes back to a policy call for the legislature, but tell us some of the pros and cons of revenue first.
Mr. Chairman, I think from a purely fiscal, non-political perspective, the sooner you do any intervention, the better. So the sooner you do new revenue or anything, your picture is going to look better because you're going to have more left in savings. Waiting for any reason, I think, is kind of a policy or political call more than a fiscal call. I think if you're just trying to balance the budget, you'd want to do it all now. However, you wouldn't necessarily want to try to balance the FY22 budget, given that there would be a delay in revenue coming on. But if you pass something now, it could come online by, midway through fiscal year 23 or so, versus if you waited another year or two, you'd have to wait even longer to get that revenue.
Thank you. Those are the questions I had. Any members of the committee have questions now they haven't asked yet, because we're going to soon run out of options. I'll just check, Representative Snyder, any more questions?
Representative Drummond, any questions? Doesn't sound like it. Representative Vance, any questions?
No, this is fine. Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Not at this time.
And Representative Perko. No response from Representative Perko. All right. Well, in any comments in closing, Representative or Mr. Painter?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think I have any additional comments other than just referring back to that joint document. That's, I think, a pretty handy reference to see the differences that the governor is proposing in terms of spending. I think it helps really lay out all of their assumptions so you can pretty clearly see those differences against their baseline. And I'd be happy to answer any questions after this committee meeting as well if any members have them.
Actually, that does raise a couple of questions I did want to ask. On the fiscal model assumption comparison sheet, the last line about the permanent fund dividend and the 50-50 based on VOR assumptions versus based on legislative finance division assumptions, can you highlight the key differences between LFD assumptions and VOR assumptions on the dividend?
Mr. Chairman, I am not aware that currently we have significant differences on the eligible applicants number. We have been using this session assuming that the same number of applicants received the dividend in fiscal year 22 as they did in fiscal year 21. And then we're assuming that the Department of Labor's population growth forecast holds true in subsequent years. I'm not sure if the Department of Revenue is using Labor's forecast. It's a little dated now. I think it's from 2017 or so. So they may be using a different number, but that's what we've been using since that was published. So that's our kind of baseline growth rate.
And then another query on your same point on the retirement. There's a actuarial evaluation on retirement as of September 2020 on OMB and December 2020 on LFD. Is there a significant difference in those?
Mr. Chairman, there is. So in fiscal year 2020, we had actuarial losses because the earnings were about 2% versus the actuarially assumed 7.38%. And so using the draft numbers that will likely be adopted in about 2 weeks at the ARM board meeting, we end up with numbers that are the same in FY22, very close in FY23, but then a little farther apart in FY24 through 30, about $40 million higher in FY24 to $66.8 million higher in FY30. And again, that's incorporating those draft FY20 losses.
Whose number is higher?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So our numbers are higher because we're incorporating the FY20 actuarial loss.
So you're actually showing more income through retirement. We've got the legislative finance has a better picture of retirement income or the retirement picture than the OMB.
Mr. Chairman, I think the difference is we're using draft numbers and they're using official numbers. Right now, that means that we have a less optimistic picture where we're showing more spending. If the same pattern held true with FY21 actuary results, which are going to be very positive, then it would flip around where OMB would have the more pessimistic assumption we're currently using, and then in December we would get to switch to a more optimistic one. So I think just our ability to use unofficial numbers right now that means that our numbers are higher, but I think next year that'll mean the opposite.
Okay. Okay, and I don't see any other questions for Mr. Painter. We do have some additional time, so I would open it up to if the Department of Revenue wanted to provide any comments or observations in connection with what we've heard just heard from Mr. Painter. I'd certainly give them the opportunity, and I'd start with Ms. Mahoney. Did you want to add anything?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. As you all have just heard, the majority of the differences in the two models really relate to the spending plan. And as I said earlier, the governor is very focused on continuing to reduce our spending. Additionally, I would just like to point out that both LFD and DOR, in regard to calculating the POMV revenues, used approximately $77.6 billion for calculating the POMV. But yesterday, that number was $80.6 billion. So it is already up $3 billion than it was at the end of April, which means when these numbers are recalculated, the POMV will continue to increase. So just also wanted to point out that I recognize that there are some differences in some, I would call them non-policy related assumptions. And so my plan is to work with both OMB and LFD where we can have consensus on some of these assumptions so we can take the noise out of this type of analysis, if you will. And what I'm referring to there would be smaller items like inflation, landing on a number that we can agree on, maybe how we use the lapse, and so that in the future when we're having these conversations with you all, it can really be focused more on the policy aspect of the governor's plans going forward. And also, I'd just like to say thank you, Mr. Chairman, to take the time to hear these financial presentations in your committee. We really do appreciate it.
Any other questions now, either for Commissioner Mahoney or Deputy Commissioner Barnhill from members of the committee? I did have one question. Commissioner Mahoney, we had talked earlier about this 70% of Harvard is funded through their endowment, and we looked up some stuff, and I just wanted to see if you'd done similar research and where you are and what you'd said at the last hearing that they were funding 70% of the university through the endowment.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that reminder. I did want to bring that up. I had speculated that the Harvard endowment funded 70% of Harvard's operating budget. But it was this past year, it was 37%. Just to point out that we did go ahead and provide a document that is currently on basis for anyone to download, which really talks about, or it really addresses the reasons why Harvard decided to make the overdraw. And what the article focused on was it recognized that, of course, you know, Harvard, like many colleges, experienced deficits while going through COVID. But the objective of increasing their draw to 2.5% more was really more about the really strong market returns. And their CFO and vice president of finance was quoted as saying that the draw, and this is the quote now, is consistent with their intent on distributing as much as they responsibly can of the endowment to support all of the endowed research and teaching activities vital to their mission. So I'd just like to close with a comment that indicates that in regard to this unstructured draw that the governor is proposing from the PERM fund, it does not, that type of a draw with the balance that we are seeing today, you know, at $80 billion, does not compromise
the principal of the fund or the inflation proofing of the fund. And I just wanted that to be out there for folks to ponder and to think about.
Thank you very much. I don't. Any last chance for questions from members of the committee? Hearing none and seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and hold on. Got to get back to my directions here. We will continue to hold the joint resolution for further review. We are going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Friday, June 4th at 1 p.m. We are going to give another try that between now and Friday we will have teams running better, but be prepared if it isn't quite running as we were hoping. Be prepared to do this sort of the quick switch from teams to the phone, and we'll proceed. We have a presentation from Angela Rodell from the Permanent Fund. We also will have some more from the Department of Revenue and the administration with regard to the proposal to put the power cost equalization funds into the Permanent Fund for management, as well as how that's going to be distributed. And then we're working. There had been a suggestion from Representative Vance that we see former Representative Halford might be available to give him some perspective on his experience in the legislature beginning in the late 70s into the 1990s with respect to different permanent fund topics that came before the legislature. And we're working to get him available. And in rough terms, I think we're probably looking about allocating about 40 minutes to each of the three presentations, and Mr. Halford would come last. So that's the plan for Friday. And with that, we are going to adjourn. The time is now 2:35 p.m., and we are adjourned.